The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 266.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He actually runs and is the host of my favorite podcast, Macro Voices. His name is Eric Townsend, and he is coming to us straight from being quarantined, I believe. And he's got some crazy stories about how he got to his quarantine place in the first place. Eric, I don't know if you want to go into that or not, but you're truly looking like a rebel today.
Well, I'm going to tell everybody that in true Rebel Capitalist Show spirit, I grew out the beard. Not because I'm ragged, lost my luggage, and don't have a razor, but because I'm committed to the Rebel Capitalist brand, and I know it's the way that you would do the interview, George, if you were me. Okay.
That's how the Rebel Capitalists roll. You got it. But you actually did lose your luggage, but we won't go down that path because we want to talk about the
It was actually stolen. I didn't lose it. It was taken from me by thieves. But yes, it was a choice of showing up unshaven or having to use tweezers, which I still do have one by one. I went with the unshaven look. And I just realized I don't have any shave. It was a second day of quarantine out of 14. So I'll be a bearded man by the time quarantine is over because I don't have any shaving equipment here.
All right. Well, hey, the first thing I wanted to dive into as far as topics is this disinflation, deflation, inflation, inflation just being transitory type of debate, because you talk to all the smartest guys and girls out there, excuse me, in the macro space, and you've had this conversation with them. And unlike other podcast hosts, you really understand what they're saying. You know, a lot of people just ask the question and get the answer and it kind of goes right over their head, but you truly understand their argument. So I wanted to go into that debate and get your take on, you know, what the smartest people are saying that are in the deflation or disinflation camp and why they're saying what they're saying. And then juxtapose that to the people that are in the inflation camp and why they're saying what they're saying and maybe what the differences between the two groups are. Because I think that although they may have extremely different opinions on how the near and long-term future looks, their conclusions and the way they see the fundamentals are actually very, very similar. So if you could go into that, that would be great.
Okay. Well, first of all, this is the most important thing that there is to understand. That doesn't mean that I understand it perfectly or anyone else does, but I feel very strongly that you can't really get the economy and markets right if you don't understand what's really happening here. Is this the beginning of a secular inflation that means similar to what started in the late 1960s and lasted all the way to 1980? We're going to have a really, really big inflation that defines societal trends and outcomes of economic situations in countries around the world? Or is this just the transitory event, the pendulum swing, if you will? We got the Biden administration saying they want to spend, you know, more money than anybody could imagine. Just a few years ago. And a lot of that is deficit spending, which means that the Treasury is going to have to borrow a whole bunch of money. Doesn't that mean that bond yields are going to go up and that potentially sets up an inflationary situation? I don't think that just the bond yields are enough to do it. I think this is probably the beginning of a secular inflation. But let's start with the other argument, which is, look, in terms of demographics, you look at Japan as an example, where Japan was 20 or 30 years ago, the United States with the baby boomer generation kind of is now. Everybody was worried about inflation in Japan in the 90s and early 2000s, and it never really happened because the demographics had changed, the number of people in the workforce had changed. We also have a changing economy where the importance of labor as an input to producing things isn't what it used to be. It used to be anything that you bought. Somebody had to use their own two hands to make that thing. Now robots and automation and, you know, automated production lines make things. And we also have a lot of the economy is based on services that are provided electronically over the web and so forth. So that labor cost component that used to be so powerful or such a determining factor in the cost of goods and services doesn't have as much influence as it used to have. That's one of the factors. You can think of a lot of reasons that deflation really, I think probably the strongest one is the amount of outstanding debt, both public sector and right. private sector. We've got so much debt that if you were to somehow meaningfully increase interest rates, and normally when inflation increases, the only reaction or the only way to for central bankers to try to fight that inflation, if they feel inclined to fight it, is by increasing short-term interest rates. So we normally associate the idea that when interest rates, or excuse me, when inflation occurs, interest rates go up. I think that unto itself is actually a little bit of a fallacy, because it's not really inflation that's causing interest rates to increase. It's inflation which is causing central bankers to take action to intentionally increase interest rates. If the bankers are, if the central bankers are not inclined to fight the inflation by increasing interest rates intentionally, I'm not sure that there's any good reason to expect the presence of inflation to cause interest rates to increase. If you get to a situation where inflation is increasing and interest rates are not increasing, that's what we call negative real yields or financial repression. That's the way that governments can systematically inflate away the purchasing power of all of the national debt that they've accumulated over the years. So they don't actually pay it back, but they sort of kind of pay it back because they're reducing the value of that outstanding dollar amount to have less purchasing power because the price of everything has gone up. So it kind of makes sense that strategically what governments ought to do, considering how deeply they've gotten themselves buried in the financial hole that they've gotten into, what are they going to do? Are they going to fess up and say, basically, we've been borrowing money and buying and spending beyond our means for the last 30 years, and now we have to have all this great austerity where, you know, the next generation is going to pay for the mistakes of the last generation? Who's going to vote for that? If the other approach is, let's print more money, let's create a situation that most people don't understand, but the result of it is people kind of feel better because wages are going up. Actually, prices are going up faster than wages, but you still feel like you're getting a raise. So it feels like things are getting a little better, but actually your savings are getting cut in half in terms of their value. But the average person doesn't understand all this stuff. So financial repression is the name that's given to the phenomenon. Some people say is an intentional tactic or strategy of central bankers. Other people just think it's kind of a consequence of central bank strategy, but it's the situation where you've got negative real interest rates that persist for a number of years. And what happens is anybody who is trying to just preserve their savings by saying, look, I'm going to take my money, I'm going to put it in a safe United States Treasury bond, a 10-year Treasury bond, surely that's got to be safe. Well, actually, it's a guaranteed significant loss because you get the nominal cash back 10 years later, you get this paltry little interest rate that doesn't even matter. And the purchasing power of the money you get back is much less than the purchasing power of the money that you put in. So many institutions, so many retirement and pension systems, by law, have to invest a significant portion of their assets in both treasuries and other fixed income instruments, that in a backdrop of financial repression, they're guaranteed losers in terms of their purchasing power, actual effective results. Well, wait a minute. Why in the world will we allow that to persist? Well, what you're basically doing is you're taking the people in society who have savings and investments, and you're taxing them in a very clever and not so obvious way to basically say, you guys that normally would get significant returns, you know, you got money to put up to lend to the government, you know, in 1982, we'd pay you 15% on that. Well, maybe we're going to have the same kind of inflation we had in 1982, but we're only going to pay you 4% on it because we're not going to do the Paul Volcker approach to trying to contain inflation. We're going to let it run. If you get into that situation, what you're basically doing is wealth redistribution. It's a way of taking away from savers and investors and giving to borrowers. You're basically making money much cheaper to borrow, allowing people of lesser means to borrow more. And I think it's worth pointing out, George, you know, maybe some of your listeners are not very big fans of the things I'm saying, but there's a lot of people who I think very understandably in society are saying, wait a minute, what you're saying is all the rich guys are not going to get as much return on their rich guy money, and we're going to bail out the people that are hurting the most on Main Street. That's good. We ought to be doing that. And I think that you're going to see much more public support for that. Now, the idea that I think some of your listeners might resonate with, which I resonate with, which is, wait a minute, the government shouldn't be, you know, conceiving these very sophisticated structures to redistribute wealth without any act of Congress or without any public debate, just as a matter of policy. And frankly, you know, it's kind of reckless and irresponsible the way they conduct themselves. I think that those of us who hold that view are going to be very much in the minority. I think that any kind of public policy that favors making it easier for the average guy to borrow money to buy a car with, even if maybe his credit's not so good and he's at risk of not paying it back, if the way society overall has to enable that transaction to happen is to pay you and me and other people that are responsible to save and invest our money a lower rate of return than we would get otherwise, most people are going to say, let's let those rich a-holes subsidize everybody else. You know, they deserve it. And so I think we've got to just accept that public policy is likely to favor policies that tend to promote financial repression, which is allowing inflation to run to some extent. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So,
right. You know, but correct me if I'm wrong, the guys and gals on the deflation side would say, okay, Eric, I totally get what you're saying, but because the debt is so high at the corporate level, at the consumer balance sheet, at the sovereign level, we're not going to, those governments aren't going to be able to create the inflation they need to get those negative interest rates and create the financial repression. Because at the end of the day, you've got to get more dollars circulating in the real economy. And if the commercial banks aren't lending because everyone's levered to the hilt, then you're going to get, in essence, fewer dollars being created because there, although there will be loans being created, more loans will be paid off. And therefore, the amount of dollars will continue to decrease, if not just velocity decreasing. And therefore, even if the governments want that game plan, execution is a completely different story. And I think that might be Dr. Lacey Hunt's argument. Snyder, I think, would have that argument, but he'd also say it's not just a matter of the commercial banks in the domestic economy under the purview of the Fed, but it's also the euro dollar system, you know, because that's broken. That's not creating enough dollars to generate this inflation to allow the government to, again, execute on that game plan. So is that what you're seeing as far as the very smart people's argument for why we won't see this type of inflation and negative real interest rates?
Yeah, you articulated that perfectly, George. Thank you. And I'm going to just attack one last nuance at the very end of what you said. Is that the reason that the conclusion is that, you know, it has to be deflation and it's not inflation? Well, almost. What I would say is everything you just said, I agree with completely. Those are all of the pro-deflation factors. And the way I think of this is deflation, think of it like a house that's burning, okay? And if you come with your little squirt gun, which is inflation, you know, so the inflation is the water you try to pour on the burning house, it's going to evaporate before it even gets to where the flames are because the heat is so hard. Right. On the other hand, if the fire department shows up, that's Ben Bernanke shows up with a, you know, great big fire engine and great big 3-inch hoses and bunch of guys, okay, that's going to get there. At some point, though, if the fire is burning hard enough, the water's not going to put it out. And what happens is eventually, in order to get enough water to put out a really big fire, a really big deflation, it's got to be so much water that the water ends up doing more water damage than the fire damage would have done when the fire was finished if you just burned it out. Because when you burn it out, you lose the building, but you don't end up flooding the surrounding area with charcoal-filled water. So what's going on here is, I think the government has been saying for the last 15 or 20 years, okay, when you have a deflationary backdrop like we have for all of the reasons that Lacey Hunt and all these other people have said, if you think like Lacey Hunt and you're responsible and grown up about it, you end up with this conclusion that this is deflationary and it's not really good for the economy and this is problematic. But if you think like a government person, what it means is we can get away with doing stuff that would normally be really inflationary, and we can basically get away with it. And yeah, maybe we're going to put so much water on this fire that in the end, the water damage really is worse than the fire ever could have been. But that's going to happen on the next guy's watch after I'm out of office. Got to think like a politician now.
Right.
If what you want to do is be a hero, you're not Ben Bernanke that's got the fire engine driving up the hill to the house. You're Janet Yellen on the radio calling in those DC-10 fire tankers that are picking up the, you know, millions of gallons of water, whatever they, not millions, thousands of gallons of water, whatever they carry. And, you know, there's all echelon formation of heavy tankers coming in to dive bomb on live television and dump all of this water. So you can declare that you have solved the, you know, you broke the deflation. And what you do in the process is you get a Janet Yellen and an AOC teamed up and you say, we're going to create universal basic income. We're going to create free health care, free college tuition. We're going to pay off everybody's student debt. We're going to do, you know, all of this stuff. And where are we going to get the money for it? We're basically pouring all this water on a fire that's burning so hot that most of that water gets evaporated before it actually does damage. Well, what happens when you have already an inbound sequence of heavy aircraft dumping more and more water, and then the fire goes out and it's not burning so hot that all the water is evaporating before it hits the ground? The water is all landing and flooding the village and everybody's drowning. Once you get into an inflation that starts to run away, it becomes nearly impossible to control. And it's not actually impossible to control. You can control it exactly the way Paul Volcker did in 1980, which is you dramatically increase short-term interest rates, and it really just knocks the wind out of the inflation, while at the same time multiplying the federal government's cost of borrowing by like 5 to 10 times what it was before. Well, wait a minute. You could do that in 1980. It's completely impossible. Paul Volcker himself, before he died, said it would be impossible for those policy solutions to work today. So what I've been saying for at least 10 years is, you know, this inflation fire, it's burning really hard. And that means people that, deflation fire is burning really hard. People who do inflationary things, and QE was inflationary. It wasn't as inflationary as a lot of people thought it would be. It was a little bit inflationary, but it wasn't enough to even begin to put out the fire. Someday we're going to put the fire out, and we're already going to have policy in place where there's more super tankers full of water inbound, dropping water, and we're going to flood everybody, and we're going to have a real problem. So I've been saying for more than a decade, I don't know when it happens, but if you look policy-wise, as long as the backdrop is deflation, the government can pretty much get away with printing money to solve almost any problem. You know, whatever goes wrong, we'll just print more money, and you know, we're not going to tax you for it. We're just going to kind of contrive it out of thin air.
Yeah.
With all the tricks that we play, the federal government is not actually, you know, printing money. It's just borrowing money. Who is it borrowing from? Well, this other part of the federal government that claims to be independent, the Federal Reserve. So now its balance sheet is expanded, and somehow we magically pushed a button and there's money that came out of thin air, and the government is deficit spending, but we didn't have to tax anybody for it. You know, doesn't that all come and haunt us someday? It haunts us when the deflation fire goes out and the water that's being thrown on this inflation no longer evaporates into the flames and it starts flooding everybody. That's runaway inflation. I have been the first to acknowledge that it would take a hell of a lot. Lacey Hunt is exactly right. It would take a hell of a lot to get from the deflationary backdrop we have all the way to a true, full-on runaway inflation like the 1970s. Is there any person on earth in whom I have confidence to pull that off? Yes, sir. AOC plus Stephanie Kelton and the whole MMT crowd are the people who have a vision. I don't happen to agree with it, but they are competent. These are not just politicians that are running around mouthing off about nonsense like most politicians. They have this plan around modern monetary theory and their idea of how it is possible to basically have a free lunch right up until the inflation starts to become a problem. And only then do you have to slow down how much money printing you can get away with in order to finance basically wealth redistribution schemes. I think that you're seeing already the political change. You know, are there politicians in office now who would do extreme enough things that would really get a runaway inflation going? Nope, nope. Are they coming? Are the people who have aspirations of being in the White House 10 years from now already on the political landscape like AOC? Yep. Are they their academic advisors like Stephanie Kelton to help them when they take office? Yep. The groundwork is being laid. And I think it's really important for investors to step back and acknowledge the people who hold these views are good people who mean well and really sincerely believe that we need to accomplish this wealth redistribution in order to correct some social injustice, which, you know, I think they're right about the social injustice. I think wealth inequality is the worst problem that we face, but not, I guess there's other problems that are even worse, but it's one of the worst problems we face. I don't think the solution is giveaways and eliminating incentive for hard work. I think it's going back to capitalism where everybody has an equal right. Doesn't matter where you're from or what your family name is or whatever. Everybody has an equal right to start a business, work hard, deliver value to the economy, and become wealthy. That incentive system is what really made the United States what it is, in my opinion. The people who I think have very well-meaning, well-intended agendas don't see that history or don't perceive it the way I do. What they see is great injustice, and the way they see for curing it is to basically invoke some very sophisticated monetary policy schemes that involve wealth that effectuate wealth redistribution, with the risk, which is openly acknowledged by the MMT crowd, that if you push it a little too hard, you can get runaway inflation. But don't worry, trust us, we got some really smart people that are going to be watching. And if it starts to get away from us, the Stephanie Keltons of the world, I trust them to tell the politicians, hey, remember I told you, when inflation gets to be a problem, you got to take your foot off the gas. It's time. And that's the point where I predict suddenly Stephanie Kelton will no longer be the favored advisor. That's not what the politicians want to hear. They want to keep spending money indefinitely, and that's what they'll do. Eventually, the inflation will run away. I'm absolutely convinced of that. Now, I thought in 2010 that it would happen by 2015. I was obviously completely wrong. Now, I'm not even willing to commit to saying it's going to happen in the 2020s, but I don't see how we could get out of the current monetary situation or the overall economic situation of over indebtedness without inflating. I mean, there's two choices. You either inflate it away or you fess up to being irresponsible and you impose austerity on the next generation in order to correct for the last generation's mistakes. And in case you haven't talked to any millennials or Gen Zers, not a lot of those guys are really feeling like they want to volunteer to take further economic pain in order to right the wrongs of their parents and grandparents. That's really not where their heads are at. So yeah. I don't think there's any reason to expect that we're going to go that direction. I think it's a question of how long can we get away with these policies before the eventual runaway inflation occurs.
Yeah, so let me try to summarize the two schools of thought using the analogy of this house that's on fire, and that's the inflation. That's the deflation. And then the water attacking it is the inflation that the government is trying to create. That's their game plan. So I think the deflationists would say, listen, that fire is so large that, you know, with your squirt guns, it's just not going to do anything. And then the people on the inflation side would say, yeah, that's true if you continue to use water squirt guns. But what we believe is they're going to continue to use the squirt guns they've used in the past, but they're also going to use a fire hose. And if the fire hose doesn't work, they're also going to use a tanker full of water. And if that doesn't work, they're going to go to you know, whatever the next level is up of water amount to put out the fire. And the disinflationists or the deinflationists say, okay, that's your view, but we don't think they can get to that level where they'll be able to create enough water to put out the fire. That's really kind of the back and forth. But both groups recognize there's a fire and both groups recognize there's a potential for water. It's just a matter of what degree of water we actually have in the future, or what the government is able to create. I think that's kind of the debate, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's the debate. And there's also the question of present tense versus speculating in the future. I think a lot of the disciplined economists that you've interviewed, whether it be Lacey Hunt or a Jeff Snyder, you know, Jeff Snyder is a very, very data-driven guy. He's got just an amazingly beautiful brain, but he operates on the data that he's got. Speculating about what might happen politically and how that might change the future is not Jeff's cup of tea. He doesn't really think that way. So I think if you, what the Lacey Hunts and the Jeff Snyders are all saying is, if I look at the current data, what I see is deflation is winning the day. It's clear, right, and they're right. There's no question about it. The question then is it prudent for you and I who think about portfolios for the next 20 years to say, okay, right now it seems pretty clear that the fire is burning and everybody in the neighborhood has all got their squirt guns out and everybody's squirting their squirt guns and it's not putting the fire out. Should we conclude that this fire is going to burn forever? Or should we conclude that if AOC and Stephanie Kelton have the ability to literally give away free tuition and universal basic income and so forth by pouring more water on the fire, that they're going to be perhaps a little bit more enterprising and a little bit more innovative than previous generations in finding new ways to supply more water to the fire than Lacey Hunt or Jeff Snyder ever could have imagined was coming? Now, if you talk to Lacey Hunt, he'll be the first to tell you, he says, absolutely, if the Federal Reserve Act were modified to allow the Federal Reserve to spend money rather than just lend money, it would completely and totally change his view. He'll say that instantly. What surprises me, and I guess Dr. Hunt is just has more respect or faith in institution than I do, is he seems to think that an actual revision of the Federal Reserve Act is necessary. I look at it as they don't follow any of their own rules. I mean, ever since 9/11, the federal government's been making up its own rules and doing whatever it wants and doesn't seem to be held accountable by anybody. I don't think a lot of things that they've already done have been legal technically, and they've done them anyway.
Yeah, Dr. they bought Hunt junk bonds, that, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. They're buying junk bonds. Dr. Hunt feels that you know, the only way that could happen is you've changed the Federal Reserve Act. And I think I asked him once in an interview, well, what if you just violate the Federal Reserve Act instead of changing it? You know, I mean, isn't that just as good? And it's important to realize, I think that the public sentiment is going to be completely behind the modern monetary theory and pro-inflation side. Yeah. So what's the risk here? We're going to inflate away the savings of all of those rich a-holes who don't deserve their savings. And we're going to use the money to take care of the poor, average, starving guy on Main Street. That's a pretty darn compelling message. In order to see that it's unfair and doesn't really serve society in the long run because it breaks an incentive system which is made possible the motivation of so many people to accomplish so many great things. Well, now you're not talking even economics anymore. You're talking about you know, philosophy or an approach to government that you and I might have a view on that a lot of people are not going to agree with. So yeah. I think that where the public sentiment is, you know, let's tax the rich. And if the way to do that is this financial repression thing, let's do that. I think that it's a matter of time before we start to see that inflation run away. I just have no idea how long it is. And so that's what I try to get my head around is how long does, because you got it exactly right, because of all this debt service and everything, we are in a deflationary setting right now, a disinflationary setting. What does it really take to break the back of that? Now, I think the COVID pandemic is a really big catalyst by itself because it forces a huge amount of government spending and a whole bunch of other government spending while also damaging productivity because a whole bunch of people can't do the things they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
The way that these things tend to work is, or at least I think that they tend to work, is it's very, very hard to tell when you're at that point of no return. But once you get into a self-reinforcing vicious cycle, it's extremely hard to break it. Paul Volcker had to get interest rates all the way up to 17% in order to break that inflation in the early 80s. And we know that that won't work today. So I think we're headed to it someday. And I really have no idea how long this excessive indebtedness is going to allow the inflationary policy actions to continue to work without leading to runaway inflation. And You know that the longer they work, the more they're going to keep upping the game. Hey, we got away with this. Let's try twice as much next year. Oh, that didn't blow up the system. Let's quadruple it the year after that. Why not just go to $100 trillion a year of federal budget, and we'll give everybody a Mercedes and a gold watch, and taxes will work backwards, and it'll work great. You could do that for some period of time before you blow the whole system up and everything collapses in hyperinflation. Well, how long do you get away with it? I don't know. It seems to like it's gone already much longer than I thought possible. Maybe it can go the rest of our lives. I don't know.
Yeah, one thing we didn't talk about is by them creating more dollars in the system, or trying to create this inflation, by them trying to find more water, let's say, they are distorting the economy to the point where, or maybe better said, they're creating an economy that's dependent upon that water. And not just dependent upon mm-hmm. that water, but dependent upon more and more and more and more of the water. So mm-hmm. so then you have that dynamic that's incentivizing, I think, the Fed and the politicians to where it's just like QE. Once you start it, you need more of it, you need more of it, you need more of it, and you can't stop it. And now it's the exact same thing. Yeah. With this government deficit spending, that we need more and more and more and more of it. Even if inflation wasn't an issue, or if they weren't trying to create mm-hmm. it, they'd still have to do more of that because of the economy being built around that that foundation.
Exactly. And look at monetary history, George. What it teaches us is everybody says, oh, you have these situations and you've got a choice between austerity versus financial repression. There's never, ever been an example in history, as far as I know, of voluntary austerity working. In other words, there have been cases where a third world country was kind of forced by its creditors, we're going to start a war with you if you don't pay your debts. You better impose some austerity. Okay, that's one thing. But as far as something like the United States ever going to let's recognize we've been reckless and irresponsible and we've borrowed and spent beyond our means, and we need to now spend a couple of generations making up for that to correct the errors of our retiring baby boomers who are playing golf on the golf course while the millennials do all the work to make up for it. Nope, I don't think that's going to sell at the polls. So, where does this eventually take us? I don't see how it could go any other way than the way history teaches us, which is the more that you get into a socialist regime, the more there's expectations, people growing up and believing that they're entitled to right. government handouts and so forth. If you grew up believing that you're entitled to that, there's no example I know of in history where people said, we've got free healthcare in this country. I've had it for my entire life. I grew up with it. I'm used to it. I've always been able to get it if I'm sick. But I'm a smart guy, and I recognize that having that policy really undermines the productivity and the competitiveness of our nation in the world, and we'd be better off without having that free Benny. Right. I mean, maybe there's one guy who thought that once. I mean, I think that right now. But as far as an entire nation voting that way, as far as I know, it's never happened, and there's no reason to ever expect it to happen. What always happens is you keep just living and borrowing and spending beyond your means until eventually the system blows up. And the thing is, the U.S. dollar, because it's the global reserve currency and it's the center of the entire global financial system, things have to get really, really, really bad before it blows up. And I think that we are on a trajectory where it almost has to someday. But the biggest mistake that I've made in my investment career and that I see most people making is when you become persuaded that there's some outcome, such as an eventual collapse of the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the financial system. Human nature is to take that conclusion that it is inevitable and somehow equate it with being imminent.
Right.
No, it's not imminent.
Right.
It's been inevitable for decades now. We knew in the late 90s that there's really no way out of the mess that we're in, because we've got this fiat money system, and history teaches a lot, but it doesn't mean it's all going to fall apart tomorrow. And that's where I disagree with, you know, as much as I'm very much a very bullish on gold, so many of the people in the gold bug community just seem to want to convince themselves that there's going to be this great financial collapse. It's probably going to happen like next Tuesday, or maybe as late as next month. It's like, no, it's truly imminent. They got that right. It has to happen
someday. Or it's inevitable. It's inevitable.
I'm sorry. Thank you. It's truly inevitable. See, that's how bad, that's how easy you make that mistake. It's truly inevitable that it has to come to a very bad end someday. But it doesn't have to be a deflationary end. It's more likely to be an inflationary end. And when that inflationary end comes is anybody's guess. And the only thing we know for sure is the entire gold bug community has a multi-decadal track record of being early. It takes longer than everybody thinks for a gigantic financial economy system like the United, like the U.S. dollar monetary system to eventually collapse under its own weight. It has to happen someday, but I think it's still a long ways off. Now, the question is, what are the alternatives? It's not really, you know, oh, it's not so bad or it is so bad. There is no viable alternative to the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency. And until there is one, I don't see how a hyperinflation could ever happen.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Let's go into that, because I think that it could happen, and I'd like to get your view on this, if the system itself and the way that we create dollars actually changes. So if they're able to figure out a new system that creates a lot more water. The way I look at this, Eric, is we've got three systems. The way it worked in the past, where the commercial banks were responsible for creating the majority of the dollars out there in the real economy when they would lend money into existence. The way I see it, we've got this hybrid system where the banks are creating dollars by lending, but the government, like we talked about before, is creating new additional dollars by spending them and having the Fed monetize it, because they're not pulling the dollars out of the system in the first place through taxation or selling those bonds to the individuals or entities in the real economy, basically going straight to the Fed where they're buying them with bank reserves. That's kind of this hybrid system. So the amount of dollars is now dependent upon the commercial banks, but also the politicians. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get into the AOC and everything that we talked about before. But in the future, I think we may go into a third system where we have a central bank digital currency, where the central bank themselves will have much more of an, let's say, influence on the amount of dollars that are being created in the real economy. And maybe this goes back to what Dr. Lacey Hunt says when he says how I'd go from a deflationist to an inflationist. I think he's talked to Grant Williams about this. He says bank reserves would have to become legal tender. And the way I see that is the Fed being able to issue loans into the real economy, creating the dollars they need, and then being able to spend money directly into the economy through UBI, and then have some sort of timer on that to increase velocity. I think that next system is how they could create the inflation that would overwhelm the fire that may bring about hyperinflation. But what do you think about that? Because I know you're an expert when it comes to this, you know, technology and the crypto space and the central bank digital currency.
There's a lot to unpack in there. So let's go through a bunch of things, but we're very much in agreement. So first of all, one of the things that you'll hear or read a lot on the internet is, you know, look out, hyperinflation is coming. It's coming to you soon. It's happened elsewhere. It's coming to the United States. For the most part, that's nonsense, but it's not totally nonsense. So let's really take this apart. The place that I think a lot of people are confused is, first, they don't understand what that word hyperinflation actually means. They'll say, we're going to have hyperinflation. It's going to be as bad as the hyperinflation in the 1970s. Well, wait a minute. The 1970s was nowhere remotely close to hyperinflation, and the right. economic drivers of that inflation had nothing to do with the economic drivers that would cause a hyperinflation. So the textbook definition, there's a number of different definitions. The most common one is hyperinflation is said to exist when there is a 50% monthly, not annual, but monthly rate of increase in the cost of goods and services in an economy. Right. That means that on an annualized basis, inflation is running more than 1,000% a year. And what's really happening, though, is it's not the same monetary phenomenon. Normally, inflation happens when there's a certain amount, there's too much money chasing a limited amount of goods and services. And so the price of both labor and goods and services goes up. That's inflation. And there's a self-reinforcing cycle that drives that. Hyperinflation is something completely different. Hyperinflation is the wholesale loss of faith in a currency system. Yeah. It's when the general public says, maybe I'm not smart enough to understand monetary systems and all that stuff because I'm just a poor pauper in Zimbabwe, but I am smart enough to understand my government is corrupt as shit. And whatever's going down here, I don't believe my own government's money. I want somebody else's money. Mm-hmm. When that happens, it's the phenomenon of the people of a nation losing faith in their own currency so that people favor just some other currency, some other government's currency.
Or some other good, anything, mm-hmm. anything that's tangible. Well, Gresham's law, basically.
Sometimes they want to buy actual hard assets, but if they're going to keep any money in currency, when they want to put it in some other nation's currency, economists actually call that phenomenon dollarization. Why? Because the favorite currency to switch into is U.S. dollars. Mm. In order to have the whole world have the U.S. people say, okay, we're losing faith in the U.S. dollar. You know, I'd rather have Canadian dollars instead of U.S. dollars, or I'd rather have euros instead of U.S. dollars. And all of the other people around the world who depend on the U.S. dollar is the central focus of the entire financial system, start losing faith in the U.S. dollar, and they want to turn to an alternative. Now, this has already started to happen, at least on a sovereign level. Russia has divested itself almost entirely of its U.S. assets. And it was predictions years ago that China and Russia would both divest their U.S. assets. They're already doing it. These things are already in motion. They're already happening. But, right. you know, the sky's not falling. What's the big deal? The thing is that there's no viable alternative yet. If you wanted to say that you're the government of Russia and you can sell your U.S. Treasury bills and buy gold bullion or buy, you know, some other asset, they're sophisticated financial actors. But as far as the average guy on the street saying, I don't trust U.S. dollars anymore, I'd rather have euros. First of all, we're a long way politically from that kind of a change in public perception, which is what it takes to get to true hyperinflation. But more importantly, there needs to be an alternative that's better. Instead of my U.S. dollars, I want to have, what, Canadian dollars? Mexican pesos? Well, wait a minute. There is one, I think, emerging. The Bitcoin maximalists would tell you it's already there. It's Bitcoin. And that's what's going to happen is people are going to lose faith in government fiat. They're all going to run to cryptocurrency instead. That's plausible. And I definitely want to just acknowledge my own mistakes in this. When I first started making predictions about this, I said, look, the problem is that governments are going to see this coming because even governments are not that stupid. Well, I guess I underestimated the stupidity of governments. They don't understand how big of a threat cryptocurrency really is to their monopoly on issuing money. Governments have a monopoly on issuing money. Everybody accepts that only the government gets to issue money. Didn't used to work that way. It was private banks that used to issue all the money. Yep. Now it's the government. Everybody's used to it. Governments aren't going to want to let that up. So I think that, and what's fascinating to me, I was surprised Grant Williams didn't take the bait, because in the interview you were referring to, at the end, Dr. Lacey Hunt says that the thing that would be really interesting would be a digital currency, a competitor, and an alternative for the U.S. dollar that's a digital currency. Now, that would be a whole different thing. And I don't think that Dr. Hunt has that technology background, so he doesn't really understand the intricacies. But he was saying, what about that? And Grant and Bill didn't take the bait on that one. I thought that was the most profound point in that entire Dollar Endgame series, which was terrific that Grant and Bill did. And they didn't take the bait when Dr. Lacey Hunt said that. What I would say is exactly what will happen is the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the global financial system will be replaced by a digital currency. Will it be a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or Ethereum, or will it be a sovereign digital currency, which could be, you know, Russia and China or somebody partnering to build something that's a competitor to try to destabilize the United States? It could be the U.S. government getting its act together and realizing that in order to maintain its hegemony over the global financial system, it needs to assert the super sovereign digital currency, the Fed dollar, or the Fed coin, as some people call it. There's lots of ways that it could go, but I don't see how you ever could get to a U.S. dollar hyperinflation until there is a dollarization mechanism, a flight to another currency system. And that other currency system, the only logical way that it makes any sense for me for that ever to happen is it's a digital currency system which offers significant benefit over conventional fiat paper currency systems. That's going to be true of all of the digital currency systems. They're all better than paper money. The Bitcoin one is better in ways that you and I might think are better, but it's not better in terms of the way the government thinks. They don't think it's better that you using Bitcoin can make it much more difficult for the government to monitor and oversee and control your financial privacy. Governments are going to design their own digital currency systems with the opposite goals of making everything traceable. That's going to be a power struggle. So I think that what happens is, you know, does the dollar eventually fall? Well, if the paper dollar is going to fall in favor of a digital currency, if it's a digital dollar from the U.S. Federal Reserve that really they actually got their shit together, which they're a long way from, that could be the way the U.S. saves its monopoly over the global financial system. If they don't do that, whoever has the emergent digital currency system that wins in terms of public opinion, that's going to be what the U.S. dollar cedes to. And it's a very unknown as to who's going to be in control of it.
Well, Eric, can you explain why that central bank digital currency is so superior to the system that we have right now? Because I think most viewers and listeners would say, well, wait a minute, Eric. I mean, basically right now the dollar is digital. How many people are going around paying with cash? Not very many people. So why is it that a central bank digital dollar Fed coin is so superior to the system we have right now?
Well, but let's actually make it, why is digital currency superior, regardless of whether it's a sovereign digital currency, a central bank digital currency, or a cryptocurrency that's like Bitcoin?
Right.
The answer is, first of all, people will tell you that the dollar has been digital for 30 years. That's utter nonsense. The dollar has been supported by digital accounting and transfer and payment systems for 30 years. So we have credit cards, and we have debit cards, and we have so forth. Those things are all creating liabilities. There are dependencies between when you spend money on buying a dozen flowers for your girlfriend. There's now an obligation that's created to where the credit card company has to pay the flower vendor, and you have to pay the credit card company. And all of these things have counterparty risks associated with them. And those counterparty risks are gamed by big banks, who actually turn them into tradable instruments. So they take these various different kinds of counterparty risk, and they securitize instruments that allow them to trade around and so forth. What you get with secure digital bearer assets, the underlying inventions that made digital currency possible, is the idea of I want to sell a stock to you, George. Well, we do it. There's no broker. There's no middleman. There's no institution in between that has a counterparty risk that could fail. Yeah, we were using some centralized stock exchange for the purpose of agreeing on a price, because we're going to go on whatever the rest of the market says the price should be. But once the transaction, the way it works today, if I buy 100 shares of stock and you happen to be the guy, even though I can't see you, I don't know your name, but you're the guy on the other side, you're selling the 100 shares of stock. There's this whole settlement process that the industry is so proud of itself. It used to take 5 days to settle a transaction. Then they got to T plus three, which was, you know, launched with all this big fanfare. It only takes us 3 days to figure out who bought the stock after you close the transaction by the time all of our systems keep up with it. Well, what you get with instantaneous digital bearer assets is the ability to design a completely different system. It says the stock exchange is just for price discovery so that you and I agree on the right price. I sell it from my ownership to your ownership instantaneously. There is no settlement. There is no clearing. All that shit happens instantaneously when the transaction goes down and you own it right then. You don't have to wait 3 days before you can sell it or any of that stuff. The fact that you don't have to wait the 3 days is not the important benefit. The important benefit is if your broker totally goes MF global overnight and it's completely bankrupt and everything's lost, you didn't lose anything because nothing is held in street name in the broker's name. It's all held in your own account. With respect to all of our financial transactions, when I write you a check, even if it's a wire transfer, there are still all of these counterparty dependencies and all of these potentials for big systematic institutional failures, a Lehman Brothers style thing that could break and take down the whole system. When you go to secure digital bearer assets and the transfer of ownership is instantaneous, online, and electronic, it is a completely different game than the last 30 years of digital money that people think of as digital money. We're talking about digital bearer assets that actually convey or transmit value through a computer network, as opposed to effectively sending a check through a computer network, which basically just informs somebody of a counterparty obligation that exists someplace else. But it's actually transmitting the value.
But do you think that additional efficiency and technology would equal a sound money from a standpoint of confidence? Because we're talking about people losing confidence in the dollar. Do you think that?
Well, you don't.
You see what I'm saying?
It doesn't have to be an either or. What you do, the benefit of digital currency is that you can get rid of a system that's based on institutions that has the systemic risk of an institutional failure taking down the entire economy. You can completely eliminate that risk. But what you've still got is basically digital fiat money. Well, if you want to be sound money, what you do is you say, let's have a digital currency system, which is actually backed. And there's several people doing this right now with gold bullion. So it is really backed by sound money, but it still has the advantages in terms of how you can transmit it. Now, immediately, what's going to happen is if you try to develop that sound money thing where every online bullion buck coin is backed by an ounce of gold in a real vault someplace, that'll last for a while until people forget why it was important that it was designed that way. And then they'll change it to where it's always redeemable for that ounce of gold, but they don't have to have all of the ounces of gold because they know from experience that nobody's ever going to all want it at once. So as long as we got enough to cover what we think, according to our models, is the most that anybody's ever going to ask for at a time, it's okay to fractionalize that and not really keep all the gold. And then it eventually gets into, you know, becoming a fiat system again. I think the greater risks, though, are the functionality. What is money and how does credit work? Well, the only way that we know to design both a money system and also to have credit in an economy is this 300-year-old design, which was really brilliant when it was, you know, like 300 years ago, called the fractional reserve banking system. My contention is this whole cryptocurrency trend of the last 12 years, this is just the very, very beginning. It hasn't started yet. What's going to happen next is we're going to realize that there's an opportunity to re-engineer money itself, not just replace the paper money with digital, you know, bitcoins, but to design a replacement for the fractional reserve banking system which makes credit possible. So that now the way we think about credit, the way that credit is delivered, and all the assumptions that all the bankers, all the investment bankers have about how their institutions provide credit to the world and everything, it's all going to be re-engineered by a new money system. The people who invent and design the money system are going to have incredible advantage and conflict of interest over everybody else because they can design features into it to benefit themselves that it will take decades for everybody else to even figure out what's going on. They can, you know, if you think about the consequences of the way lending works today, okay, when there's all this lending and it creates all this, you know, this debt, well, that leads to a situation which eventually, as Dr. Lacey Hunt, you described his arguments very well earlier, when you get over indebted, it leads to deflationary pressures and so forth. What if all of those assumptions, everything we know about how fractional reserve banking works and how lending works, were completely thrown out the window? And a bunch of guys in Silicon Valley, and we know we can trust guys in Silicon Valley because we've never been let down by like the social media inventors in terms of over-influencing society.
Right.
Suppose that same group of boys and girls in Silicon Valley.
I want to mention, I want to point out your sarcasm there, Eric, for the audience.
Imagine that same crowd that invented social media and you know gave us the iPhone that takes your fingerprint and sends it to the NSA and you know when when they introduced that product there were people lined up outside the Apple store around the block in sleeping bags despite the fact that you could pre-order it online to have it delivered by FedEx to your house on the day that they introduced it. You know, that whole phenomenon of what's going on, imagine that growing to the point where Facebook or Google or somebody has invented better money. The way the credit is created is more innovative, more flexible, and it has better features than the fractional reserve banking system offered. It's basically Silicon Valley re-engineers fractional reserve banking. Not to make it, well, on the surface, the advertisement, just like social media, it's to make it better for everybody. What we want to do is just give everybody in the world something free, social media, that you'll really love. There's no downside to it to you, and we're giving it to you for free. So how could you possibly argue? What they're going to be doing will be much worse than the social media agenda. What they'll be doing is redesigning how money itself actually works, how credit formation occurs, and they'll be designing features into it to benefit themselves. And it is scary because we do need this. It is better, but it is beyond government bureaucrats' ability to understand all the technological nuances. So you're not going to have a government regulator from the, you know, the newly created Federal Cryptocurrency Oversight Board come in and understand, like Jeff Snyder could understand, what we're going to do to re-engineer the fractional reserve banking system to eliminate this whole M1, M2 concept and redo the way credit works. And there's lots of different ideas that I have. Some of them are in my book, but you know, what am I saying? How would credit be different in the current system? I don't know, but I know that Silicon Valley guys are good at re-engineering the way old stuff works into new ways that benefits them in not so obvious ways. And I think that's what's coming. So the race will be on for who designs the currency system that actually replaces the US dollar as the central focal point of the global economy.
But
the
why is
maximalists think it's
I was just going to
you
know, go there. So. Yeah, I was going to say, why not? Just a quick Reader's Digest version of why it's not Bitcoin.
I think, well, first of all, let me tell you why not. Then let me tell you why I've been wrong so far. What I've said is the reason why not is because governments have a monopoly over issuing money. Almost nobody questions that, even though historically it wasn't always government that issued money. Nobody questions that. There's a huge benefit to government to issuing money. Government ought to be smart enough to figure out that when that monopoly is threatened, they will use the force that they have as government, you know, guns and jail cells and so forth, to stop that from happening. Well, why have I gotten that one wrong so far? Because this technology is new enough and governments are stupid enough that, as far as I can tell, most people in the U.S. federal government and the Federal Reserve still don't get it. They don't understand that digital currency is inherently superior to fiat conventional currency. And what they're focusing on is they're looking at the design features of Bitcoin. It was designed intentionally to be pseudonymous so that it's not really always clear who the actors are. Not all the accounts are, you know, titled to somebody that can be, you know, you can't seize it by the IRS. They're looking at it and they're saying, this is not a money system that we would ever have designed or approved of. You know, we're not going to recognize this as a real money system. No, of course not. It was designed to be exactly what you don't want. What happens when they finally wake up and say, oh, but wait, the underlying technology, the invention of the secure digital bearer asset would allow us to design this Orwellian digital currency system that would allow everything to be tracked, monitored, and controlled by the government. And all we have to do is basically steal the technology innovations that the crypto guys invented and then apply the exact opposite set of design objectives to designing our own CBDC system. Well, they're already doing that. They haven't, for some reason, gotten tough on Bitcoin yet and tried to really outlaw it. I always said it'll never get to the point of serious institutional adoption because it'll be outlawed first. Well, guess what? I was wrong about that. We're seeing serious institutional adoption of Bitcoin as an asset class. And the more that big institutions with lots of lobbying power and influence, politicians in their pocket, own this thing, the less likely it is to be outlawed. Bitcoin does pose the risk to governments of having the whole world just decide they like Bitcoin better and they're going to, you know, no longer accept the government's monopoly over issuing money. We'd rather use Bitcoin. I can't see it getting to that point because governments have so much to gain by waking up and realizing that they could use this technology to advance their own agendas opposite the design of Bitcoin, that they'll eventually do that. And I used to think the governments would finally wake up. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, it's really more likely that Silicon Valley will see this opportunity and they'll do one of two things, or maybe some very clever combination of both things. They'll either say to governments, look, you need don't let these cryptocurrencies take over the world. You need to maintain your monopoly, but you need us, Silicon Valley, to build you a super cool digital currency system that is going to work better than, you know, your existing system. You know, let us design it for you and build it for you and sell it to you, and, you know, we'll get mega rich on this. But then I realized, wait a minute, they're much better off if they use what Silicon Valley is good at, which is just giving stuff away seemingly for free, when in reality it's very expensive because it's stealing all of your data, what they did with social media. What if they just really focused on making money a lot easier to use so that all your transfers, you know, you can do everything in your phone very easily. It's all based on facial recognition and fingerprints and all these convenience things that are also collecting your fingerprint and your facial recognition and you know, saving them in a database that can be sold later to governments. Let's suppose it's not Libra, which has already kind of been struck down, although it seems like they're trying to resurrect it. Let's suppose Google or Apple or Facebook or somebody comes up with Libra Plus, you know, a new Silicon Valley digital currency system. But they realize this time they can't just ignore the government. So what they do is they go to the government and say, listen, here's what we're doing. We're building this. It's going to be kind of like Libra that pissed you guys off, but we're doing it differently this time. We're building in all these features that are going to collect everybody's thumbprint, everybody's facial, and we're ready to sign a completely confidential agreement right now with the federal government that you just back off and let us do this, because we are going to make the world better with better money. We're going to also give you like this back channel of free, you know, collection of everybody's data. Right, we're going to design it so that we can deliver the government not only the ability to trace everything that happened in the history of this monetary system, but to go and claw it back and seize it retroactively after the fact. We're going to give you these incredibly powerful law enforcement features that you don't need to go figure out how to design the system to do it. We're going to build those features in. You, federal government, let us be in charge. Let us, Google or Facebook, be in charge of designing how money works. And what we'll give you in exchange is a much better stranglehold on society and its personal data than you could ever have imagined accomplishing yourself. Now, Matt, put yourself in the shoes of the Federal Reserve, and they got the NSA, you know, director guy who's there, and you know that meeting. And they're saying, you know, Facebook or Google, we're going to design this incredible currency system. Everybody's going to love it. And it's going to give the government much more control over everything than it ever had before. Who's not going to agree to that? Why wouldn't that happen? That's what scares me the most, because I think that Silicon Valley, in partnership with the U.S. federal government, could mount the greatest assault on individual human liberties and information rights in the history of mankind. And I think that's probably coming. And I think that it will go over as a great success in the eyes of most of the population, because they'll have this cool new money where borrowing money is easier than it used to be, where all your transfers and all your electronic things all happen very, you know, intuitively. It's like stuff that was designed by Apple, not the stuff that was designed by Citibank. It's super easy to use. It's automatic. You scan your friend's face and say, pay her $100. And, you know, it's automatic because it knows her face. It's got it in the database. That scares the hell out of you and me. It sounds much better to the average person. It sounds convenient. I can just point my phone at my friend and her face is going to tell the system. I don't even have to know her bank account number. It's going to automatically do it from her face. That's cool, man. Well, you and I are, and a lot of your listeners are smart enough to think about the not so obvious consequences and, knock-on effects of that system existing and what it could be abused for in the future. Most people are not going to see that. They're just going to say, better money. It comes from Facebook. It must be good. And the federal government endorses it because they're getting a bunch of stuff that we didn't even know about because it's in a sealed FISA court document someplace. That it turns out that every time you ever, spend a nickel on buying a piece of candy, you know, the government is tracking that in a database someplace.
Eric, is I went out with this gal the other night, and she was, I don't know how old she was. She was probably late 20s or something like that. And
everybody's going to skip forward past my whole interview and want to know who the women are that George Gammon really dates, how old they really are. What's the average percentage of their age? Let's get to some statistics that'll actually give this podcast some numbers. And then maybe somebody will listen to my shit. Like, in order to get this,
we'll have to put this in the title. But now, so I'm out with this gal, maybe late 20s or something like that. She pulls up this app on her phone to show me how cool it is, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? So she clicks on this, and it's like this map of the United States, and there are all these little dots going around the map. And I'm like, okay, well, what are those dots? Why is this cool? And she goes, because you can see where all your friends are. I'm like, wait a minute. I said, you're telling me that you sign up to this voluntarily and all your friends sign up to this voluntarily so you can all see each other where your exact physical location where you are at all times. And she goes, yeah, it's so precise. I can see even when my friends are in the front of a building or in the back of a building. She's like, isn't that cool? And I'm like, I've got words for that, and cool is not one of them.
Well, I'll give you a feature that I bet she'd like even more. What if she didn't have to worry about these decisions she makes about when to pay how much of the credit card bill to pay off and all that stuff? What if it was automated for her? And the friendly folks at Facebook took care of making those day-to-day financial decisions for her. And they automatically just made the payment she needed to make and managed her cash flow so that she could just not think about money and trust Facebook to be in charge.
Yeah, right.
You and I might just laugh at that, but there's an entire generation who's like, what is wrong with these, okay, boomer idiots that don't get it? Like it's much better if Facebook automates all that so I don't have to think about, how much credit they are deciding to let me run up just because they happen to have bought the creditor that's not obvious because it's all in a digital system that was designed to make it unobvious that the regulators on the U.S. government side that approved this because they got suckered in by that offer of some free data collection, never thought about it, never realized the consequences of. If money itself is re-engineered and redesigned to do something differently, and the way the credit system works is re-engineered to operate differently than it does, whoever designs it has just as much advantage as, let's say, a nation that gains, control of space has militarily, because you can drop bombs on any country from a spaceship. You've got this profound advantage that nobody's going to regulate, nobody's going to understand. And we're going to get to a situation where there really is better money. And when Facebook or Google or whoever does it invents better digital money, It's going to be way better than Bitcoin. It's going to be way better than anything else we've seen. It's going to be convenient, easy, simple. It's going to seem to 90% of the population like it's just obviously better.
Right.
Once that happens, voices like you and me on podcasts saying, guys, you're not thinking about the consequences of this. Why did the federal government agree to this? What are they getting out of it? What does this mean for digital privacy rights? The people who worry about those things are a bunch of nutcases in the eyes of mainstream population. And I'm happy, you know, I'm proud nutcase in that case, but
you and me both
are not going to change the outcome. But that's the important thing is it's the worst mistake that people who agree with us can make is to say, well, you know, I don't believe that shit. I agree with Eric and George. So that's what's really going to go down. No, Eric and George are going to be overruled by a much, much larger majority of people who I think are misinformed, but there's more of them than there are of us, and they're in charge. We're the old guys, you know.
Yeah.
We're not in charge of what happens next in society. Millennials and Gen Z will decide that, and they are very much not on the same page you and I are. I mean, some of them are, but in terms of the social direction, what's next? Let's figure out what universal basic income is really going to mean to changing incentives in society, and you know, start to think about how many decades it will take before we get through to the getting people to recognize the consequences and knock-on effects that you and I see of eliminating the capitalist system of incentives. You know, as soon as everybody is entitled to a certain basic income, it means nobody is given the imperative that in order to survive, you need to go and work hard, what you and I were taught. And then I think a lot of younger people hearing that would say, why in the world would you want to have that imperative? Isn't it better if people can just chill and enjoy life and live on their UBI, and like, what's your problem?
Yeah.
You and I have a philosophy that was instilled into us because of our generation, that the generation that's in charge of things now doesn't agree with, and we need to get ready for change. We don't have to like it.
Yeah. Okay. So I know I've kept you too long here, Eric, but one thing I want to kind of just go the complete opposite direction for just the last couple minutes here. We've talked about all the technology and the central bank digital currency and Bitcoin and money. Give us your thoughts on oil, because I know that, you know, in a past life you were in the technology space, but now, as of the last decade, you've really become an expert on the oil space. And I know that's something that's most of my audience is really interested in, commodities in general. So where are we right now with oil, and where do you see us going in the next year or two?
Crude oil is the biggest and most important commodity. It's the largest dollar volume of commodities ever traded because it is the source of energy for the entire global economy. And the problem that we face is that the ESG movement has made the decision to stop investing in new oil and gas exploration because everybody agrees that oil and gas should be phased out in favor of more sustainable energy solutions. I'm in complete agreement with that. It's one wee little problem. We've stopped making the investments in new oil and gas exploration already. And as far as I'm concerned, the advances that have been supposedly made towards electrifying the economy and replacing all the internal combustion engines with electric vehicles are completely inflated out of realistic proportion. Yes, it's a super important trend. It's exactly the right thing. It's what we should be doing. I'm all for the environmental agenda. But to think that in the course of, say, the next 10 years, we're going to eliminate the need for fossil fuels is ridiculous. We don't have a good solution for aircraft, even in the case of road vehicles, although electric vehicles are offering, they're finally becoming cost competitive and are offering a lot of superiority. We still are faced with the fact that our electrical grid is nowhere close to capable of recharging all of the electric vehicles that would be needed to electrify the economy. So if you want to get rid of oil and gas, you got to get rid of, if you want to get rid of oil and gas, you've got to provide an alternative that's a complete alternative where you've got the electric distribution grid and everything else that's needed to do it. We're uninvesting in oil and gas too soon. And I think that that means the final years of the age of oil will be defined by high prices, not low prices, which is what most people seem to think. They're thinking, you know, it's oil and gas is getting phased out, so the price is going to go down, is less and less demand for it. No, I think what's going to happen is supply is going to go down faster than demand, and supply is going down because people are not investing. It's very expensive to and it's very understandable. Who wants to invest in, you know, the old pitch? Everybody's seen the old pitch. If we make this investment on this oil well, conventional oil wells before shale oil, for the next 25 years, it's going to be paying off. Well, who cares in 25 years? We don't know what kind of fuel the economy is going to use. Shale wells, really, the economic benefit gets paid off in the first 2 or 3 years. So I think it makes sense to continue investing there. But the investment in offshore oil rigs, we ought to be now really gearing up for deep water offshore exploration, because eventually the shale patch is going to get drilled up like Swiss cheese. There's not going to be enough capacity to add more shale oil. And we're not going to have electrified the economy in time. So I think we get to a really big price squeeze in the end. But, you know, it's moving targets. There's lots of policy things that could change this. Right now, we have inflation that I think is driving oil prices. We've got the lack of investment that I just described longer term. And in the shorter term, we've got just over the COVID crisis, you know, there was a complete cessation of investment because there was too much oil. And, you know, now we're starting to come back up. Oil prices are back up to above where they were pre-pandemic. I think they're going quite a bit higher from here. Eventually, you know, we're going to get to a point where we've got a real problem unless we start reinvesting, or we can do something much quicker to build out a new electric grid and really, and you know, if you were to take all of something I think is very realistic, if you take our previous conversation, suppose the Stephanie Keltons and the AOC said, look, we need to have a green economy. We're just going to make it simple. Every American has the birthright to own a Tesla or a, you know, whatever your favorite electric car is. You don't have to qualify. You just need to be born in the United States and you can have one, and, you know, we'll make a payment plan for you. Because it's all going to be subsidized by the federal government. That seems to me like a plausible thing that could happen. They would have to also build out the electric grid. They'd have to do all kinds of stuff. Let's suppose that, and I think it's also possible that they could start subsidizing the purchase of those electric vehicles long before the electric grid is even addressed. Because when you make the promise of everybody's, you know, entitled to an electric vehicle that you qualify for just by being a citizen, that's a way to buy votes. Admitting that we don't actually have the electric grid to support all of those vehicles and it would never work anyway, that's not a way to buy votes. So that's going to get delayed. Eventually, you got too many electric vehicles. It's impossible to charge them all. Nobody planned ahead for this. We realize that it's not possible to build out the fully electrified economy until we redo the entire electric grid. We realize that that's a public works project that's much bigger than anybody understood. It's going to take 10 years to do it. And oh shit, we stopped investing in oil and gas. And now oil's $250 a barrel, and you know we're having to ration it because we screwed up. I think that's probably where we're headed. But there's so many moving parts. You know, you could easily see where something changes and it goes the other direction.
All right. So I think we summed up everything very well there. We talked about the technology. We also talked about the tangible stuff, the oil. So, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, Macro Voices is my favorite podcast. That's where I really enjoy listening to the smartest people in the room talk about what their ideas are. And so, Eric, for my listeners who want to find out more about Macro Voices, where can they go to do that? Where can they follow you on social media to make sure that they're being spied on by the social media groups in Silicon Valley we were talking about earlier?
Well, I'm on quarantine, so I don't have my Macro Voices polo shirt. It's not in this luggage.
Yeah.
It's macrovoices.com, or go to any podcast player and it's Macro Voices. What we try to differentiate on is we try to be the more sophisticated, more for finance professionals and sophisticated investors. Certainly, at least half of our audience is retail investors, but they're the sophisticated ones that kind of stopped being interested in the beginner podcast. So we try to fill that void. And it's macrovoices.com.
Awesome. Eric, I appreciate your time. Good luck with your luggage. And I can't wait to have another conversation soon.
Okay, George, my pleasure.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you, you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist Show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, Luke Groman, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.